content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service. And for the next hour, I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com. That is gsuggsinsurance.com, or call 919-875-8889. For those of you who have been listening to the elongated back issue programs, I'm excited to say there's another new edition of Time on my table today, dated February 10, 2025. As usual, the front cover is bordered in red with a narrow white inner border. Time is in white, large block, capital lettering, and is superimposed what appears to be more an illustration than a photograph of an office, a blue sky behind panels of window with gold drapes flanking either side of the tall window, a fancy ornate desk in the foreground with a gentleman seated at the desk shoving things off the desk, including sunglasses, papers, a stack, a telephone, some kind of either a goblet or a vase because liquid is splashing from it. It is a caricature of President Trump, blue suit, white shirt, red tie, looking stern, if not fiercely, at the camera. Again, I'm pretty sure this is not an actual photo, but rather an illustration. And the caption reads, "He's back." Beginning with the brief, "The Price of Disaster" by Alana Samuels. There's a photo here. It's a full-page photo, mostly brown and gray. "The insurance market in California sends warning signs nationally. In the far background is a gray, smoky, cloudy, or foggy sky, or maybe all of the above. The vast foreground is that of a probably suburban setting. There are streets, clearly there are streets, but everything else is in rubbles except there's one whitish-looking house standing. There's a blue and white VW bus in one of the streets. There are a few additional rooftops. Otherwise, everything's in shambles. This would be the result of the fires we will see. And again, Alana Samuels writes this. Insurance companies were worried about the Pacific Palisades neighborhood of Los Angeles long before devastating wildfires burned through the area, ravaging homes and forcing evacuations. The Palisades, because of its location next to the brush-heavy Santa Monica Mountains, was too vulnerable to fires to insure at permissible rates without losing money. Insurers, including State Farm, which dropped nearly 70% of policy holders in Pacific Palisades in July 2024, refused to offer new insurance plans or renew old ones. As a result, many homeowners were forced to obtain coverage from the state's insurer of last resort, the California Fair Access to Insurance Requirements, CAFAIR plan, which covered 1,430 homeowners in the Pacific Palisades zip code of 90272 in September 2024, an 85% increase from 2023. The FAIR plan insures homes against fire, but has higher premiums than traditional insurance and only covers up to $3 million in damages for residential properties. Like many other insurers of last resort, in the 33 other states with this type of system, the California FAIR plan is buckling under the weight of natural disasters worsened by climate change. I am concerned that we are one bad fire season away from complete insolvency, said Jim Wood, then a California assemblyman, at a March 2024 hearing in which CA FAIR plan president Victoria Roach explained that it had just $200 million of cash on hand with $450 billion of exposure in the state. That bad fire season is now here, as infernos burned across Los Angeles County, torching at least 40,000 acres. Analysts at CoreLogic, a risk modeling company, estimated losses could reach $45 billion. It is a blow to the hundreds of insurers operating in California, but a particular challenge for the state's insurer of last resort. Its predicament highlights the precarity of the home insurance market in California and nationally. Because of an increased risk of fires, floods, hurricanes, and other natural disasters, it does not make financial sense for insurers to offer plans to some people. In the long term, we are not doing enough to deal with the underlying driver, which is fossil fuels and greenhouse gas emissions, so we are going to continue to see insurance unavailability, said Dave Jones, former insurance commissioner of California, now director of the Climate Risk Initiative at the University of California, Berkeley School of Law. We are marching steadily toward an uninsurable future in this country. As insurers drop policyholders, homeowners turn to insurers of last resort, sometimes called beach and windstorm plans, that cannot really afford to insure them either. Yet more states are creating these plans to bolster private property insurance markets. Nationwide, the number of FAIR plan insurance policies nearly doubled from 2018 to 2023, rising to 2.7 million, according to data from AM Best, a company that rates the financial strength of insurers. The California FAIR plan alone saw its exposure grow ninefold over the past 6 years. The fate of the California FAIR plan affects everyone in the nation's most populous state. Insurers are responsible for covering the first $1 billion of claims in California. But then the responsibility goes to all insurance policyholders in the state, who are responsible for additional assessed charges. Essentially, everyone has to pay to reimburse people whose homes lie in high-risk areas. Florida is a case in point, when Citizens, the state-run insurer of last resort, could not pay out claims. Policyholders paid the bill, which added up to a hurricane tax of hundreds of dollars per household after Hurricane Ian hit near Cape Canaveral in 2022. The way FAIR plans work is really a symptom of the broader insurance market failing, says David Marlett, managing director of the Brantley Risk and Insurance Center at Appalachian State University. In some ways, it is useful for people to be priced out. The insurance market is one way of signaling where people should not live. More expensive plans may divert people from high-risk areas. But as the insurance math becomes unworkable in wider swaths of the country, FAIR plans will not be a tenable solution. We need to be dramatically rethinking how homeowners insurance works and what it covers, he says. One potential fix would be for the federal government to offer to provide insurance called reinsurance for fair plans, essentially backstopping them if they do not have enough money to pay out claims, says Jones, the former insurance commissioner. That would also help fair plans save money on buying insurance from the private markets. Jones also suggests creating an Obamacare-style marketplace for home insurance, where the government could subsidize low or moderate-income households buying insurance. What will not work, experts say, is continuing with the same system and hoping climate risk just goes away. Insurers are not magicians, Jones says. The risks of loss are rising through climate change, and insurers cannot just wave a magic wand and make them go away. Here's a half-page photo in color. It looks like a group of young men. Oh, there are a couple of women in the background. Two are hugging one another. Set free is the caption. Marlon Brando Diaz, who was imprisoned for taking part in Cuban anti-government protests in 2021, hugs his family upon his release in Havana January 16. Cuba started releasing some prisoners after the Biden administration said it was removing the U.S. designation of Cuba as a state sponsor of terrorism, a decision quickly reversed by the Trump administration. The Bulletin, this is by Andrew R. Chow, amid TikTok uncertainty, U.S. users flock to China's red note. It has been a dizzying few weeks for TikTok. January 15, the Supreme Court upheld Congress's ban of the app, which passed last year because of security concerns about the app's Chinese ownership. A couple days later, the app went dark, but access was restored before President Trump signed an executive order attempting to stall the ban. While TikTok's fate hangs in the balance, many creators are migrating to another Chinese-owned app, Xiaohongshu, a social media app often referred to as Red Note in English. China's Instagram, Red Note, was founded in 2013 and now has more than 300 million users, most of whom are Mandarin speakers in mainland China. The app is filled with travelogues, beauty tutorials, animal videos, and live shopping feeds. When TikTok's demise seemed imminent in mid-January, many of its users announced they would be moving to Red Note, sparking a migration. Red Note topped the App Store for days, gaining millions of new users in search of a new community, cultural exchange. In the first few days of Red Note's ascendance, Chinese users and American newcomers, who dubbed themselves TikTok refugees, greeted each other excitedly, carrying out bilingual conversations using subtitles about medical bills and cultural stereotypes. For some users, the very act of being on another Chinese app was a political statement and a protest of a ban they saw as paternalistic. It was a bit of a spite thing, says Christina Schuler, a South Carolina-based woodworking entrepreneur who joined Red Note and quickly gained 15,000 followers. Hopefully I can be part of the crowd that maybe can change how our government views this whole situation. Uncertain future. TikTok's sudden return January 19, after less than a day offline, complicates the future of both apps in the U.S., which in 2020 forced the sale of the Chinese-owned gay dating app Grindr or Grindr to an American owner. Red Note also faces competition from Instagram Reels, R-E-E-L-S, and YouTube Shorts. But the app's rise demonstrates the feeling of many Americans that online community and culture override any privacy, data, or geopolitical concerns. The brief news, good question. Kate Middleton's cancer is in remission. What does that mean? By Alice Park. There's a small photograph here in color of the Princess of Wales dressed in red visiting the Royal Marsden Hospital January 14. Seated opposite her is a woman in what looks like a big blue cozy chair. She has a shawl over her shoulders. She's dressed otherwise in casual attire, and she has what looks like a helmet, a gray helmet on her head. She is smiling as she and the princess apparently converse. After announcing in March 2024 that she had been diagnosed with cancer, Kate Middleton, Princess of Wales, has provided a positive update on her illness. "It is a relief now to be in remission, and I remain focused on recovery," Middleton announced on X, January 14. The statement comes a few months after she revealed in September that she had completed chemotherapy treatment. There's still a lot we do not know about the princess's case, including what type of cancer she had and the exact type of chemotherapy she used. And being in remission, while a positive development, comes with plenty of uncertainty. Remission means doctors have successfully reduced the signs and symptoms of cancer, in some cases to undetectable levels. Remission quite simply means that at that point there is no detectable sign that cancer is in the body on all of the tests we have done, says Dr. Sikander Ailawadhi, an oncologist and professor of medicine at Mayo Clinic. That does not necessarily mean the cancer is completely gone, but it does mean doctors cannot find it after thoroughly testing for it. "The word remission is a very, very tricky word," says Dr. Marlene Myers, professor of medicine and director of the survivorship program at Perlmutter Cancer Center of NYU Langone Health. "The common use of the word, even among oncologists, if they say someone is in remission, is that it means we have knowledge that it could come back. But at the moment, there is no evidence of cancer." The way the term remission is used can vary from person to person, and really physician to physician, says Dr. Christopher Flowers, head of the Division of Cancer Medicine at the University of Texas, M.D. Anderson Cancer Center. The National Cancer Institute, for example, defines two types of remission, partial and complete. In complete remission, all signs and symptoms of cancer have disappeared, while in partial remission, the cancer may be reduced but remain in the body. It is not clear from Middleton's announcement which kind of remission her cancer is in. Doctors stress that being in remission does not mean a patient is cured, but if people remain in complete remission for at least 5 years, they are more likely to be cured of their cancer. "You have to have complete remission to be cured," says Dr. Larry Norton, oncologist and medical director of the Evelyn H. Lowder Breast Center at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. "But complete remission does not guarantee you are cured. Cancer is notorious for recurring, even after remission, and some types are more likely to do so than others. Certain kinds of cancer, such as the brain cancer, glioblastoma multiforme, even if it's gone, it's going to come back very soon," says Ailawadhi. "Similarly, pancreatic cancer, bladder cancer, and ovarian cancer have a very high risk of coming back despite treatment, despite complete responses, despite remission. Small numbers of cancerous cells that doctors cannot detect may start growing at any time. Most patients in remission from any type of cancer generally continue to work with their doctors to monitor for any signs of these recurrences, including more frequent screening and testing for signs of cancer. As anyone who has experienced a cancer diagnosis will know, the princess wrote in her social media post, it takes time to adjust to a new normal. She noted she's looking forward to a fulfilling year ahead and thanked the staff at the Royal Marsden Hospital, where she was treated, for looking after me so well during the past year. The princess has limited her royal duties since her diagnosis, but recently appeared at the family's annual Christmas Day service in Sandringham and hosted the Together at Christmas Carol service at Westminster Abbey in early December. I tell my patients remission is an important milestone on the cancer journey. To know you're on the pathway to cure, says Flowers, it is the most positive first step to be in remission. The brief milestones next are two lengthier articles, as well as 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 very short thumbnail items. First, well, actually, two firsts. There are two dieds in the larger article column. Died Cecile Richards, a lifelong activist, by Elise Hogue. Hogue is co-founder and CEO of Democratic Futures Institute. In 2014, I found myself sitting across from Cecile Richards at a D.C. eatery. She was president of Planned Parenthood, and I had recently become president of NARAL, N-A-R-A-L, Pro-Choice America, now Reproductive Freedom for All. She had taken me out to congratulate me and, as I later learned, induct me into a sisterhood of women who left perfectly respectable careers to fight for abortion rights. A former union organizer, Richards, who died January 20 at 67, turned attacks into opportunities. When the Susan G. Komen Foundation said it would defund Planned Parenthood because it provided abortions, she unleashed a juggernaut of fundraising, bolstering resources for wars to come. After Dobbs, she developed Charlie the Chatbot, which dispensed medically accurate information. Richards leaves a legacy of fearless service and a shining example for young women. And the second died with larger articles. This is David Lynch, the most Lynchian of them all, by Stephanie Zakarik. There's a photo here of David Lynch. It's very strange because it's a perfectly lovely photograph of the face and head of a sort of young man. He's looking directly into the camera's lens with tousled grayish hair. But what's interesting about it are the colors used. There's red in the center covering nearly all the face with shades of blue on either side. Cigarettes, coffee, candy, according to legend and to people who spent time with him. These were the things David Lynch would fuel up on, substances that kept him going and contributed to the mad, cosmic swirl of ideas that found their way to our lasting pleasure from his brain to the screen. Lynch, who died January 15, just a few days shy of his 79th birthday, was so extraordinary that his last name became the foundation of a descriptive adjective. But if he inspired countless filmmakers and TV creators, no one was more Lynchian than David Lynch. From his unnerving, hypnotic, black-and-white feature debut, Eraserhead, to his heartland reverie, The Straight Story, to his rapturously out there, game-changing TV series Twin Peaks, Lynch's inventions could feel a little intimidating at first. But once you gave yourself over to being beguiled, charmed, weirded out, you only wanted more. He made strange things seem normal, and normal things feel strange. For those who were not around at the time, it's hard to convey how Blue Velvet, 1986, Lynch's seductive, depraved, exhilarating parable about the dark, mossy underside of otherwise sunny, small-town life, seemed to blow a hole in the world. And his 2001 Mulholland Drive begins in sun-drenched Hollywood, the kind of place where dreams come true every day, only to swerve into a seedy nightmare version of itself. Hollywood means so many things. It exists in multiple dimensions at once. Mulholland Drive brought that home. The quintessentially American filmmaker, Lynch was alive to all the things we do and think and hope for. Even as he probed secrets, we would rather keep under wraps. Always, though, he found beauty and joy in trees and birdsong, in the bluest of skies, the reddest of roses, the whitest of picket fences. We may sometimes believe we live in awful times, but really we are lucky to be alive right now. We are lucky to have been alive in the age of Lynch. Now for the seven short items. Resigned, Israeli military chief Lieutenant General Herzi Halevi, on January 21, citing security failures related to Hamas October 7, 2023 attack. Requested warrants for two top Taliban officials for alleged gender-based crimes by the International Criminal Court. The court's chief prosecutor announced the move January 23, saying his office had concluded the officials are criminally responsible for persecuting Afghan girls and women. Killed at least 76 people after a fire tore through a hotel at a ski resort in Turkey January 21, confirmed Marco Rubio by U.S. Senate as Secretary of State January 20, pleaded a British teenager, Alex Rudakubana, guilty January 20 to murdering three young girls and attempting to kill 10 people at a dance class in England in July. Died Jewel Pfeiffer, Pulitzer Prize-winning cartoonist and Phantom Toll Booth illustrator, at 95, January 17. Slammed the Gulf Coast and southeastern U.S. by a powerful winter storm. The week of January 21, at least 10 people died amid the brutal weather, according to the New York Times, as cities that rarely see snow, such as Houston and New Orleans, were blanketed. The Brief Health, Five Ways to Master Doing Things Alone, by Angela Haupt. As a recent college graduate in a new city, Samantha Elliott thought she would be lonely. Instead, she found companionship in the most unexpected place, with herself, and that ironically helped expand her community. Being alone has this negative connotation, like it's punishment, but you are learning to be friends with yourself, says Elliot, who is 24. Over the past few years, she has gone on solo hikes and to concerts, museums, movies, dinners, almost always making friends in the process. Spending time going places and doing things alone can be transformative, says Jessica Gaddy, a therapist in Los Angeles and avid solo traveler. She encourages many of her clients to become more comfortable with solitude as a means of self-care and self-exploration, and she helps them overcome their fears around venturing out alone. Whether you are taking yourself across the world or to a coffee shop on the other side of town, you're breaking outside your comfort zone, she says. That grows your capacity to take on other challenges in your day-to-day life. Amid an epidemic of loneliness, it might seem counterintuitive to carve out alone time. But as long as you also have a strong social network, research shows quality solo time boosts happiness, curbs stress, improves life satisfaction. It can even make you more productive and creative. You have this isolated time to drown out the noise and influences from other people, Gaddy says. With that in mind, we asked experts how to perfect the art of spending time alone. Here is a list of five with descriptions. One, start with a low-stakes outing. Write down what you would like to do solo, ranked from the most intimidating activity to the least, Gaddy suggests. Traveling internationally or attending a concert might be a 10, for example, while going to the park may be a 3. Then brainstorm ways to make the easiest one less nerve-wracking and go for it. When she coaches clients through this exercise, they usually come back and say, "Oh, that wasn't so bad at all," Gaddy says. Two, bring along a distraction at first. When you start going places alone, it can be helpful to have something to focus on, like a book or journal. You are giving yourself something that grounds you and reminds you of who you are, even when you are not around other people, says Sana Koja, a somatic therapist in Houston who focuses on teaching clients mind-body techniques like breath work. Eventually, as you get more comfortable, you will likely feel empowered to ditch whatever you are busying yourself with and engage more directly with your surroundings. But in the early days, distractions provide a welcome sense of solace. 3. Lean into moments of connection. On a solo adventure, Elliot tells herself that even though she may have arrived alone, she is not actually there by herself. She is surrounded by potential friends. That mindset shift has helped her meet lots of interesting people. Her go-to icebreaker when she goes somewhere is to admit she is nervous to be there by herself, but that she could not resist the beautiful decor. Or she might ask what the person sitting next to her recommends on the menu. It becomes less being alone and more just, I'm doing this thing to seek connections outside of who I already have in my circle, she says. 4. If you feel awkward, remind yourself of your why, W-H-Y. Gaddy's clients are often skeptical about going places alone because they do not want others to assume they are friendless. Won't everyone gawk at the weirdo claiming a table for one? Probably not. We tend to believe people are paying more attention to us than they actually are, Gaddy says. In reality, no one is likely to notice or care who you are with or what you are doing. They're too focused on themselves. Keep sight of your why, the reason you're trying to get more comfortable by being with your own company. If your goal is to travel outside the state or the country by yourself, then remind yourself this is a step toward that goal, she says. 5. Celebrate your accomplishment. Next time you venture out alone, reframe it as taking yourself on a date. When you get home, spend a few minutes celebrating the experience, Koja suggests. Maybe that means journaling or posting a selfie on Instagram. Give yourself kudos for stepping outside your comfort zone, even if it felt hard or if things did not go exactly as planned. That way you associate doing something alone with celebration, she adds, which will buoy your efforts going forward. Here's the last page with 7 questions. Let me verify this. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Alice Park writes this, and it will be in question-answer format. Dr. Vivek Murthy, and I'm going to spell that, V-I-V-E-K, M-U-R-T-H-Y, the outgoing U.S. Surgeon General, on his years as the nation's doctor, the link between community and health and how to care for one another. There's a photo here in black and white of Dr. Murthy in uniform. Maybe it will tell us somewhere in here as to which branch of the service he serves. Anyway, it's a dark colored uniform, double-breasted jacket, lots of stripes on both sleeves, white shirt, dark tie. Looks like a gray-haired gentleman, smiling widely for the camera. Okay, first question. How can health officials rebuild the public's trust in science and health institutions? Answer. We have to ask ourselves how we can do better so people do not feel judged. When we have a relationship with the public, they come to know people in institutions and how they make decisions. It does not guarantee people will trust them, but it increases the chances significantly. Question. You wrote a parting prescription for the nation. Is that a Surgeon General tradition? Answer. Not that I'm aware of, but for me, this was important to do. I realized over two terms that there were critical questions I've been grappling with. What was driving the deeper pain, the unhappiness I was seeing for years across the country? I wanted to lay out some of the answers I have found. Question. You focus on the need to rebuild a sense of community. How do you define community? Answer. Community is a place where we have relationships, help each other, and where we find purpose in each other. For many people, that sense of community has eroded. We have millions of Americans struggling with loneliness, a third of adults and half of young people. People's participation in both formal and informal service remains low, and more than half of young adults in a recent survey said they felt either low or no sense of meaning and purpose. These are all red flags. They're warning signs telling us the fundamental elements we need to live fulfilling lives are vanishing. Question, what effect does that have on the public's health? Answer, we are starting to see many different manifestations, some mental, others physical. When people struggle with loneliness and isolation, it impacts their productivity and engagement at work, also how kids do in school. When community is weak, we are more easily polarized, divided, turned against each other. Question, you oversaw the response to one of the biggest public health threats in U.S. history. Have any lessons from COVID-19 changed healthcare? Answer, health misinformation spread rapidly, and many people did not know who to trust, but trust in friends, family members, and individual doctors, nurses, and local health departments often remained healthy, even though trust in larger institutions may have eroded. We have to invest a lot more in doing the hard work to build those local relationships, which are going to become central to approaches to future pandemics. Question, how can we as a country start to build community? Answer, when people are not invested in each other, it makes it hard to come together and advocate for and support the policy solutions we need. If I don't have children and don't know people who have children, or if I am not caring for an aging parent or do not know people who are, then I won't go out to advocate for safer schools and home care. But if I am connected to my neighbors, friends, and family, then their concerns become my concerns. Question, what's next for you after you leave the Surgeon General's office? Answer, I asked my kids what I should do after being Surgeon General. It probably says something about me that I'm looking for career advice from a 6- and 8-year-old. They smiled and said, Papa, we think you should spend more time playing with us. I thought that was the right advice. There are a lot of big challenges we face as a country, but I think these moments of great change and uncertainty can also be powerful moments for us to ask the question, how can we live better lives? How can we make changes to create a better world for our children? Those are the questions I want us to grapple with now. If we do that, then I feel very optimistic we have what it takes to create a community all of us deeply need in our lives and ultimately help us find the fulfillment we all seek. Here are two pages labeled light box. It is a double page photography spread. It's mostly dark gray smoke with some orange red fire, and around the edges, really blending into all this smokiness and fire, what appear to be tents, they're brightly colored, yellow, green, pink, some white, some blue, orange, some other flat rooftops, very crowded community. Catastrophe averted is the caption. Smoke rises from a fire at a camp set up near the confluence of the Ganges, Yamuna, and Saraswati rivers during the Maha Kumbh festival in Prayagraj, India, January 19. Considered to be the world's largest religious gathering, the Hindu festival includes a series of ritual baths and runs 45 days. Millions of people were expected to travel to the region to attend this year's gathering. Officials said the fire caused by a gas cylinder exploding was quickly contained with no reported injuries. Photographic credit goes to Rajesh Kumar Singh, AP. The problem with medical credit cards, money, by Alana Samuels. I will abridge this fairly lengthy article. David Zhao signed up for a medical credit card while supine in a dentist chair. In December 2018, the consumer lawyer from Los Angeles went for a routine appointment at Western Dental in San Mateo in the suburbs of San Francisco. Zhao was told by the dentist his gums were receding. He needed a special mouth guard or he'd have to have surgery, he recalls being told. Zhao says that he asked if the mouth guard was covered by insurance and that office staff said most of the cost was not. Instead, Zhao says, he was told he could sign up for a payment plan used by many of Western Dental's patients. As he lay in the chair, Zhao recalls an assistant came over with a clipboard and a document for him to initial. Zhao normally would have read each page of the document closely, scrutinizing the terms, but he had fluoride trays in his mouth and was stressed by his gum condition. In hindsight, it was duress, he says. After the appointment was over, he recalls a Western Dental employee gave him a gift bag and escorted him out of the office. 3 weeks later, Zhao got a bill from Synchrony Bank, which owns Care Credit, that's one word, the largest medical credit card company in the U.S. It was for $1,200. Among the charges on the statement, which was reviewed by Time, were $425 for a mold made of his mouth and $290 for the contents of the gift bag, which included an expensive mechanical toothbrush Zhao says he had not requested. But that was just the first surprise. Though the dentist's office had told Zhao he was signing up for a payment plan with no interest, he says, in fact, he had signed up for what's known as a deferred interest credit card, which charges no interest on payments during a promotional period, but imposes hefty fees on top of the original payments if the user does not pay off the entire balance within that time. Zhao says he had to take out a chunk of his savings to pay off the card so he would not be charged 26.99% in the deferred interest. I never want to have anything to do with the dentist ever again, Zhao says. Western Dental said it had no history of any complaints with Zhao's account and it could not comment further. Synchrony Bank said it could not comment specifically on Zhao's case. but said in a statement its financing solutions are transparent and clear, and that it has saved cardholders billions of dollars in interest over the years. Zhao's experience is not just the story of a bad encounter with a medical provider. It highlights the way medical credit cards are increasingly pushed on patients across America as the costs of health, dental, and veterinary procedures rise. Care Credit had 12 million cardholders and 270,000 participating providers in 2024, up from 4.4 million cardholders and 177,000 participating providers a decade prior, according to a May 2023 report by the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, CFPB. The growing promotion and use of medical cards and installment loans, the CFPB wrote, can increase the financial burden on patients who may pay more than they otherwise would pay and may compromise medical outcomes. Revenue for the medical patient financing industry was $15.3 billion in 2023, according to a report by the research firm Ibis World, which found that as health care becomes less affordable because of rising premiums and insurance gaps, more patients are turning to medical loans or installment plans. Medical credit cards may seem like a boon to both patients and providers. Doctors' offices can get paid up front without needing to chase down clients for billing or insurance reimbursement, while customers can get approved on the spot to finance procedures they might otherwise not be able to afford. The deferred interest component, which touts zero interest loans during the promotional window, may also appeal to customers at a moment when interest rates are high. But some cards can come with startling terms and hidden costs, consumer advocates say. Consumers who do not make a minimum payment each month and pay off the entire balance of their card during the promotional period are charged all the interest that would have accrued since the original purchase date at rates that can top 30%. Care Credit is the subject of a lawsuit seeking class action status that was filed in New York in August 2024. It argues the card's interest rates, 32.99% in May 2024, violate state usury laws, which cap interest rates on loan payments. Synchrony told Time it could not comment about that lawsuit. I don't think people understand what they're signing up for, says Elizabeth Benjamin, managing director of the Community Service Society of New York, a nonprofit research and advocacy group for people facing economic insecurity. There are people who sign up for these Care Credit programs who do not even have $500 in savings. There is a larger question of whether problems with deferred interest credit cards should be blamed on the card companies themselves or on providers who allegedly mislead customers about what they're actually signing up for. Benjamin and other consumer advocates say unscrupulous doctors, dentists, and veterinarians sometimes push consumers into signing up for medical credit cards, even when their insurance or Medicaid will cover the procedure, or when they could potentially get financial assistance from nonprofit hospitals. Some providers sign patients up without properly explaining how deferred interest works or making it clear people are signing up for a credit card at all, says Joy Doctor, senior attorney at Western Center on Law and Poverty, which provides advocacy services in California. In such cases, Doctor says, and that is spelled D-O-C-K-T-E-R, it is the providers, not the product they're pushing, that is the primary culprit. Still, Doctor says, the medical credit card providers make it so easy for them to be bad actors. And that article was abridged. The View world. This will also be abridged. The ceasefire. History is clear on the date the war between Israel and Hamas began, but 15 months after October 7, 2023, when a fragile agreement went into effect, Hamas resuming the release of hostages and Israel the freeing of Palestinian prisoners, it was unclear what exactly January 19, 2025 marked. Is this the beginning of the end of the war or a pause just long enough to take stock? No one wins this war. By Max Rodenbeck. Again, this will probably be abridged. Rodenbeck was a foreign correspondent for The Economist. After 15 months of agony, the Gaza ceasefire comes as a colossal relief, not just for Palestinians and Israelis, but also for the wider Middle East. True, the deal is narrow in size and scope. It covers a physical space scarcely bigger than Martha's Vineyard. The actual terms of the first phase of the ceasefire agreement extend no further than a pause in fighting, an exchange of some hostages, and a partial Israeli withdrawal. Given recent precedent, the fragility of Israel's ruling coalition, and the yawning gap between the belligerents, this deal is just as likely to collapse, or simply to lapse, as to foster a longer-term peace. Still, even a temporary lowering of the regional heart rate allows for useful reflection. Perhaps not since the Arab-Israeli War of 1967 has the Mideast puzzle been so swiftly and wholly transformed. In those 6 days, Israel upended a two-decade-long status quo, shattering Arab dreams, expanding America's role, and making the Jewish state an occupying power over millions of Palestinians. By contrast, the Gaza crisis has lasted far longer than any previous Arab-Israeli clash. An epidemiological study in The Lancet suggests 70,000 Palestinians may have been killed, more than three times the total of Israelis killed in every war and terrorist attack since 1948. Even so, Hamas's easy breach of Israeli defenses, October 7, 2023, and Israel's loss of 1,200 lives in a single day were an unprecedented shock to the nation. And as in 1967, the reverberations of the war have reached beyond the immediate parties in unexpected ways. At a dinner in Cairo, a guest speaks with dark sarcasm of the singular achievements of Yahya Sinwar, the Hamas mastermind of October 7. Isn't it amazing how one man achieved in 1 year what millions of people could not do in decades, she asks. Because of him, Israel destroyed Hezbollah in Lebanon. Because of that, the Assad regime fell in Syria. Because of that, Iran's axis of resistance collapsed. She adds, Sinwar's genius also prolonged Benjamin Netanyahu's political life as Israel's prime minister and rescued the Egyptian leader Abdel Fattah el-Sisi. The sarcasm is merited. Hamas was allied to and funded by the now strategically diminished Islamic Republic of Iran. The Assad family in Syria were no special friends to Hamas, but Israel took advantage of their fall to obliterate Syria's entire arsenal of heavy weapons, putting one more potential regional adversary out of military action. For perhaps a generation, Netanyahu is far more popular in Israel than before the war, and the Egyptian leader who viciously persecuted Hamas' parent organization, the Muslim Brotherhood, has been reprieved by Western creditors in reward for maintaining a stony silence over Gaza. To be fair, Sinwar, at immense cost to both Israelis and Palestinians, did achieve some of his real aims. He put the plight of Palestinians back in the global spotlight. He shamed Israel provoking a response so violent it has severely damaged the country's moral standing. But the Hamas leader's reckless play has left Israel, as it was briefly after the 1967 war, a mini-hegemon in the region. Its Arab neighbors are military dwarves by comparison, most cases too absorbed in internal affairs to care much for the fate of the Palestinians. Iran has burned its fingers, and Washington now has a new, even more gung-ho, Israel-first administration than Joe Biden's, which bankrolled Israel's Gaza offensive to the tune of $17.9 billion. After 1967, Israel adopted an undeclared policy of creeping annexation and colonization. The result is that today it rules over populations of Palestinians and of Jewish Israelis, almost equal in number, but disturbingly skewed in terms of rights and wealth and outlook. This is hardly a recipe for peaceful coexistence. Can Israel now rise to the wisdom of being magnanimous in victory? Alas, the signs are not good. And that was only marginally abbreviated. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.